So we always start Sangha night by saluting the shrine. Things that we do often can become a habit, and maybe we just do it because everybody else is doing it. So it's always good to sort of actually spend a lot of time of reflecting on why. Why do we do that? Is it at all meaningful for you, or are you just doing it because everyone else is doing it? Or, you know?
It's very beautiful tonight, particularly.
Yeah.
The shrine, yeah.
So you've had a response to the beauty of the shrine, and that helped you engage and maybe fueled some of the feeling behind when you salute the shrine. I don't know if anyone else has that experience. I mean, certainly for me, whenever I see a beautiful shrine, I do have that experience, or I see a beautiful rupa. But actually, even if it's one that I really don't like, because to be quite honest, there are quite a few statues of the Buddha, particularly in tree retina centres, that I don't particularly like. I have to sort of work with my preferences, my sort of aesthetic sense. And then because actually, it's a representation of the Buddha. You know, it isn't the actual Buddha, but it's our representation of the Buddha, and by saluting it, we're connecting with our faith, our inspiration, our desire to be more like the Buddha, to follow the Buddha's pathway. And in a way, any images, any mantras, any statues, a shrine, is a way of helping us to do that, to get more in contact with those feelings of faith. Yeah. So I'm giving a little, I'm going to be a slightly different format, I'm going to give a little wee mini talk, then we're going to do some meditation. I'll have a tea break, and then after the meditation we're going to pair up and talk about our meditation with somebody from the particular aspect that I'll say a bit more about you. We'll share a bit, and then from that I'm going to give a bit more of a talk. So it'll be slightly different. But yeah, so when we bow down and when we make offerings to Buddha, we're in a way we're expressing our respect, we're honouring the Buddha as, you know, someone who trod a certain path, gained a certain experience, has shared the teachings to help us do that. We're not seeing him as a god, but we are seeing him maybe as the ideal that we can aspire to, as a fully developed human being who's had all kinds of insights into reality. But there's also a side that we're relating to our own potential to do that too. You know, to our own Buddha nature, our own Buddha seeds, if you want to use that language. So Sangha Rinpoche, our founder, has talked about, you know, what's ultimate in ourselves, you know, responding to that in the Buddha and in the teachings and with other people who are sort of spiritually developed, around this whole idea of faith, Shraddha, where we're, you know, what is meaningful to us, what does our heart resonate with. So I'm just going to read a few quotes from him. So when he's talking about Shraddha, which is sometimes translated as faith, but not like blind faith, and sometimes as confidence or trust, it's often connected with more devotional side of practice, or what keeps us going on the path when times are tough. We need that kind of heart response, that emotional response. So he says, when we're confronted by some embodiment of enlightenment, either in the form of an image or description, even in a living person, then the response, or emotional response, is really the response of our potential to actual enlightenment. There's something deep down within us which has a sort of affinity with what is fully realised, fully expressed, fully achieved in that embodiment of enlightenment. There's a sort of kinship. It's rather like two musical instruments. You strike one, and the other musical instrument by its side starts vibrating in unison, as it were. So when we are confronted by this sort of embodiment of enlightenment, we respond. Because deep down in us, there is that capacity, that potentiality for enlightenment. And faith, we may say, is the response, a real living response of the whole being, and especially the emotional part of our being, to something we may not be able to have a very clear idea of conceptually or intellectually, but but something we intuitively perceive and feel, if you like, is maybe greater, higher, nobler, more sublime, more worthwhile, of higher value than ourselves as we are now. Something to which we may want to dedicate ourselves or even surrender ourselves. Something for the sake of which we want to live, even sacrifice ourselves. And he's saying, without faith, there is no spiritual life, there's no development. And that the effort we put into our spiritual development, it needs to be directed towards the growth of all of us, our psyche, our unconscious, everything. We need to unify energies, try and get the cooperation of all the unconscious parts of ourselves on that path. And one of the things he said, I talked last week about the language of the depths, is that, you know, the rational approach won't do it, not by itself, you know, and we need to bring in our imagination and maybe a more devotional side, using myth, symbol, archetype, responding on a different level than just our intellectual being, yeah? And in order to do that, we also need to feel we have our own sense of the Buddha and his teachings and what that means. Yeah. Maybe it's just an intuitive sense that there's something true, something real, something valuable, something inspiring. But that, in a way, will be different for everybody. There'll be different things that inspire you. Maybe it's the Buddha, certain stories about the Buddha, certain qualities about the Buddha. Maybe it's his smile, an image or something like that. Maybe it's particular teaching, maybe it's the idea of Sangha, or maybe you've experienced somebody who you felt is a lot more spiritually advanced than you, and sometimes those people have a real energy or presence about them, don't they? You can't quite put it into words. You know, they might not be totally enlightened, but you know that they've got somewhere further than you, and you're responding to that. That's something that I personally have found has helped me as well in the past to connect with what might be possible for myself. Yeah. So, I'm saying all that because, in a way, this whole series on Akshobhya, the whole idea of having a year devoted to Akshobhya, is that we begin to open to that kind of way of practice, alongside what else we've been doing. So maybe we're opening a bit more to the imagination, to archetype, to symbol, to devotion, find out our own relationship to some of the symbolism within the archetypal imagery or like Shobia, maybe even coming into an imagination or emotional relationship with the figure or the Buddha. Yeah.
What's Akshobhya?
Okay. Akshobhya is the dark blue Buddha of the East. He's part of the archetypal, well, people sometimes call it the archetypal mandala of five Buddhas. So you've got the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni, but then much later you have all these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, yeah, who speak a different kind of truth, you know, and there's very much a lot of imagery and stuff. And one of the things that emerged over time, you had Akshobhya, you had Amitabha, and then this mandala where you've got five Buddhas, different colours, a white Buddha in the centre. You enter at the eastern gate with Akshobhya, dark blue Buddha, and then you go round to the yellow Buddha, the red Buddha, the green Buddha. And each of them, you could say, are imaginative embodiments of qualities of enlightenment in the Buddha, expressed in kind of myth, archetype, symbolism. Each of them has a whole set of different images, symbols associated with them that hopefully resonate on all kinds of levels with us. And you could also say they each represent a different approach or path to practice. But any one of them, if you explore deeply, contains all the qualities of enlightenment. So it's not like there is a literal split that you've got the wisdom Buddha, which Akshobhya is, and all, he's only got wisdom. And you've got the Amitabha in the West, who's the head of the compassionate family, you know. Akshobhya has compassion, Amitabha has wisdom, they've all got energy, they've all got lots of different qualities, but certain ones are highlighted. So with Akshobhya, You know, all of the Buddhas in the five mandala, the mantra of the five Buddhas are seen as the head of the families of Buddhism, of other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, yeah, with different qualities. So he's head of what's called the Vajra family, and that's the wisdom family. He also happens to be head of all the wrathful figures, but we'll explore that all on another evening. So if you're attracted to Akshobhya, there is something about maybe being attracted to the path of wisdom and insight, you know, in a way that maybe if you're a different kind of person, you might be more attracted to Amitabha or to Megasiddhi, or a different time in your practice, you might find yourself being drawn more to one, or finding one more inspiring or supportive. Yeah. But I thought it would be really great if over this next 5 years we explore all of them in quite a lot of depth, and kind of collectively, so that it can be part of our collective unconscious, our collective practice, maybe even feeling under the protection of that particular Buddha during that year. Those of us who like to think, respond, practice in that kind of a way. So that's a big, long answer to your question, Jonathan. Yeah. Okay. So as I said, he's associated with wisdom. So in Buddhism, wisdom is not the same as having a lot of knowledge about something. You know, there's a sense of wisdom and truth and insight, and insight into reality and the way things really are. So often, well, part of the enlightenment experience is it described as being able to see things as they really are, and that wisdom aspect, yeah? There can be a pure awareness, spaciousness, seeing everything that's going on, going beyond dualities, beyond our view, our conditioning. Yeah? And that's the ideal, but that's not where we are now. Yeah, but we can be working to have more awareness, to have more insight, to have more clarity, to have more wisdom. I think sometimes we can feel quite intimidated. Certainly I always felt completely intimidated by the word enlightenment. I still do, you know. You know, wisdom is a big word, isn't it? Insight can be a very big word. But we all do have little insights here and there, don't we, in everyday lives. And we can have spiritual insights, little ones, big ones, as we practice, before we get to that ultimate awakening. Yeah. So I think if we actually allow ourselves to do that, maybe have that part of what we want to do, and more open to that, include that aspect in our practice, that can be really helpful. And with any meditation, you know, with Buddhism, there's sort of two main categories of how we approach meditation or what meditation might be. So there's the shamatha practices, which are very much about establishing, you know, sort of calm, positivity, sort of integration, you know, positive emotional states. And from that place, then usually you would go much more into consciously trying for insight practice, which is the vipassana aspect, seeing through, letting go, all that kind of stuff. But there's always those two elements in our lives, always those two elements in any meditation practice we do. Yeah. Often we focus much more on the emotional side or trying to get more integrated, you know, because we need to do that. But I think it's also important to bring in that wisdom aspect and sometimes have that sort of focus in our practice, even if it's in a little way. So the particular wisdom that Akshobhya is associated with is called mirror-like wisdom. I mean, he's also associated with the element water. And when you have a big body of water and it's calm like a lake or a big pond, you know, it reflects everything back like a mirror. Yeah, and like a mirror, you put something into its field of vision, it will reflect it back. You take it away, it's not there anymore. And unless it's, you know, one of those weird sort of concave or whatever convex mirrors that's not normal, it will give a fairly accurate depiction of what is in front of it. It's not going to distort things, it's going to add things, it's not going to take things away, it'll just show you this is how you look today, or this is, you know, this is that, yeah. So when we're trying to cultivate mirror-like wisdom, we're trying to see if we can do that more in our minds. Because we often, even if we're not even unconscious, we see something, we have a reaction, we have thoughts about it, we have views about it. We might have all kinds of stories, all kinds of, you know, other layers of reactions and feelings on top of that. Yeah? And we're not often aware that we're doing that. Or even if we are aware that we're doing that, we still quite like doing it, and it's a habit, so we just keep on doing that. Yeah. So once you start trying to cultivate mirror-like wisdom, A, you recognise you're doing that, and you just see if you could maybe not do that reactivity, not do that judgment, just see what is. You know, you're meditating, you're fidgeting, you're feeling very restless. Okay, you just see that you're feeling restless, physically restless. Notice what's going on in your body. Maybe there's some aches and pains, you know. Maybe there's something going on emotionally, you know. There's a lot going on in your life that you're anxious about, something you're really excited about, you've had a difficult communication with someone. You just notice, well, this is what I'm feeling now. This is the emotion, this is how I'm responding, this is how I'm reacting. Notice the thoughts that are arising, you know. And there can be lots and lots and lots of things happening at any given time, so just, oh, this is here, this is here, this is here, this is here. And try and do that without making judgments, without pushing things away, without clinging on to things. Just seeing what is, just seeing what is, just seeing what is. Whatever is arising in your mind, in your practice, during that sit. Yeah. So, you know, for me, and you can do it in everyday life as well. For me today, I've had lots and lots of meetings. Some of them were really delightful, you know, really nice communication, went really smoothly. It was just, you know, felt really, really connected with some people. I had a couple that were really quite challenging and difficult and painful, you know. Even though with someone I cared really dearly about, we had very different feelings, quite strongly, misunderstandings. The first one I just came away feeling, oh, yeah. We did then later on have another conversation, which didn't make us have the same view, but we kind of understood each other more, and we came into much better communication again, so it doesn't feel so painful. Now, the only way I was able to do that was because I could just actually look at my experience and, yeah, this happened, this is my response, and I'm reacting, and I'm going, you know, rather than get into all the stories, I could say, yeah, well, this happened, I didn't like it, I'm responding like this, I'm feeling like this, but it's not necessarily to any of the stories that I might get into, you know, that are my habit because of the things that have happened to me in the past. So what is true? What is the reality? And then let's check that out with that other person, you know, and then that opened out something different. Because I had that clarity and maybe a little bit less reactivity because I have that clarity. If you see what I mean. Anyway. So, I think mirror-like wisdom can be really helpful when we're going through a turbulent time or a difficult time, or turning towards things that we find difficult in ourselves, that we don't like, or maybe we judge, you know. Just be aware of there's the judgment or this is the feeling, but actually that's not necessarily true. But just, well, this is my reality. I can't change my reality. This is actually how I am right now. But just see, rather than get into all this about me, that about me, and I'm a rubbish meditator or whatever else it is that you're telling yourself or you believe. Yeah. So yeah, in a practice, rather than thinking, oh, that wasn't a good practice, I was so distracted. Just get interested, just see what actually happened. What are the distractions? Oh, this happened, then this happened, this happened, this is how I responded. You know. Then it becomes actually a mindfulness awareness practice. Then it also becomes partly cultivating more insight. And it's a gateway towards you becoming more insightful, more aware. We're never going to stop our minds being busy. We're never going to stop ourselves having reactions and conditioning and views. But as we become more aware of the conditioning and views, we can see through them, we can be less reactive. And even if we're feeling something quite intensely, we can be aware that's not the whole reality. And we can be aware that maybe there'll be consequences if we react immediately from that place. Yeah. So I think it's really helpful to be very much in the body. I think it's really helpful to be connected with the breath, you know, to be very in tune with what other feelings are happening, especially I like this, I don't like this responses that are happening at any given time. But, yeah, it's also good to have some clarity. You know, sometimes people think clarity, being rational, and I know I was saying earlier, you know, practice isn't all about the rational mind, but actually we do need to bring that into our practice at times as well, and into our lives at times. So from that point of view, cultivating mirror-like wisdom can be really supportive to our spiritual development. Okay. So what I'm going to suggest is that we now meditate for about half an hour, and I'm going to suggest that we actually do a period of what we call just sitting. Yeah? Where basically we are just sitting with our experience, you know, being aware of our physical experience, sensations in the body coming and going, our emotional experience, feelings coming and going, any thoughts, our mental state. There'll be a flow. Stuff will be happening. Maybe something feels like it's there for a while. Something else might arise. But just see if we can have a kind of like openness, receptiveness, monitoring what's happening, noticing our responses, noting our responses to our responses, noticing any critical voices, any judgments that are coming in. Just bring awareness to what you saw. You know, bring mirror-like wisdom, what did you experience? Yeah? And then after the tea break, we'll pair up with someone and just think, well, what did you notice? Yeah? No judgment, just what did you notice in that practice? Okay. So I talked earlier about him being the head of the Vajra or the wisdom family, and in a way you could see him as the embodiment of wisdom aspect of enlightenment, or wisdom as a sort of path approach to practice. And one of the things that's great about these figures is that they're not linear, they're not rational, they're not, you know, you can focus on this aspect of them, that aspect of them, that thing that's associated with them. And there are a lot of things that Ashobhya is associated with in his kind of symbolism that have resonances with wisdom. So dawn as his time of day, you know, darkness gradually, light you can see, you know, when before it was dark and you couldn't, you know, just like, you know, we're going through our life deluded, all our kind of conditioning, our delusions, like, you know, practice, we might not be aware of it changing us, but at a certain point suddenly we're aware of something, or we have an insight, or we can do something differently, we're less reactive. We understand the Dharma or the teachings in a way that we never have before. We can apply it in a way that we never have before. And you can't pinpoint it at any particular time, just like you can't necessarily at dawn pinpoint when it suddenly becomes light. But there's this gradual process that's happening, and then suddenly something else has happened and emerged, yeah? And you can see more clearly, you know? And there's all that big, broad world out there that you can see where before it was just darkness, yeah? So that's one of the symbolisms around him, around wisdom. We've talked about that mirror-like wisdom, seeing things as they are, not distorting them, not adding, not taking away, that kind of clarity. Yeah. And there's also the Vajra, you know. So the Vajra family is the wisdom family, because the Vajra... Well, Ratnaprabha's going to be doing a lot about the Vajra in a couple of weeks' time. But it is a symbol of reality, you know. There's a lot of symbolism in the Vajra, and also the different aspects of reality. So you could, if you want to, you could see one half of the Vajra being like samsara, one side nirvana, one things like the poisons being transformed into sort of spiritual qualities. You could also see that, you know, you've gone beyond all duality, that's all kind of united in the Vajra. But also, one of the things about the Vajra is it's seen as a diamond thunderbolt, that it's impervious to harm. Nothing can scratch or affect a Vajra, but a Vajra can do absolutely anything. So it's along in that kind of tradition that you have in a lot of different, you know, mythologies, fairy tales, spiritual things, you know, like lightning, thunder, as a sort of insight, but something that cuts through in quite a sudden way, you know, sometimes in quite a shocking way that sort of sends you into a bit of turmoil. I like from now every now and again to sort of do myself a tarot spread. I got quite interested in that in the past. Again, that's a system that uses a lot of imagery, symbolism and stuff. And there's a card in it called the Tower. And in the deck that I've got, you've got a picture of a tower, and there's a thunderbolt that's sort of broken the top of the tower, and there's a couple of people who are falling. And when you get the tower, it's sort of an indication that, you know, either something's really going to be stirring you up through your external life, or, you know, you might have had a sort of particular insight or experience that's going to stir you up there, but your fixed views or your comfortable thing is all going to get thrown in disarray, kind of thing. It's one of those cards that, you know, certainly if I see it, I think, oh, you know, do I really want to have this card here? But actually, it's a really important part of one's process in life, and sometimes we need that, because without something forcefully breaking the particular structures or conditioning that we've, you know, accumulated or built up in our lives, we're just going to stay with it forever. We actually need something outside to come and break through it. Or is it coming from outside? Maybe it's not coming from outside either. Anyway, so that's another aspect of the wisdom, that sometimes we'll have an insight that just cuts through. You know, we just see things differently. It challenges our views. And after we've had that insight, we can't go back to the old way, the old deluded way, because we've seen something that we hadn't seen before. And that, again, may cause us a lot of time to sort of make sense of it, integrate it, change, but it's sort of like quite a profound experience, which isn't to say that the sort of more gradual stuff isn't also profound, but it's a different way that we might encounter wisdom. You've also got the water as his element, you know, and water and the depths, you know, is often unconscious, often with the sort of feminine, that kind of intuitive wisdom. So there's all different ways that he's connected with wisdom, yeah? And I think we maybe need to allow ourselves to cultivate all those different ways in our own practice as well. And you may have come across the teaching about in the seen, only the seen. In the herd, only the herd. We did have a reading of that in the puja on Buddha Day. And it's one of the teachings that the Buddha gave, or was privy to give, to a guy called Bahia of the bark garment, who asked for a teaching. And in the Pali canon, you often have the Buddha meeting people, or people coming to meet him, asking him for a teaching, and he gives them a teaching, and quite often then they'll become enlightened on the spot. Also inspired, they want to join him and, you know, his community. And this is a teaching that has always resonated very much with me, and I think is very much an expression of mirror-like wisdom. So I am going to read it again. That whole thing about, you know, what we sense, we just have the actual experience. And if you smell something, you just have that experience of the smell. Not whether you like it or don't like it, or what it is, or whatever. If you hear a sound, again, it's just a sound. I'm a musician, so I'm very, very sensitive to sound. You know, I certainly have sounds that I find more pleasant aesthetically. It doesn't have to be a beautiful, you know, like sometimes something like a bit of heavy rock can be a really enjoyable sound or something. But I notice very much my tendency to categorise sounds as sounds I like, sounds I don't like, or sounds that, you know, for instance, Muzak, I can't bear Muzak, you know. And sometimes when you're watching a TV show or something and they're putting in a soundtrack and it's so manipulative, because it's like, you ought to feel this emotion now, so you're getting bits of music to try and make you feel that emotion now, you know. So I find myself having those kinds of judgments, or even outside. It's, yeah, I mean, and you can do it in quite subtle ways as well. And I remember when I was on retreat in America, and there was this bullfrog, and it makes quite a noise, actually. A really, quite a grating, loud noise, you know. And at first I was thinking, what is that? Is that something kind of mechanical? Is there some digging or something going on or whatever it is? And I was sort of like getting kind of irritated by it. And then when I sort of thought, oh, well, it's a prog, I decided suddenly it was a nice song, you know, just because of my view, really. And I have noted, you know, for instance, at Tarraloka, where I was on retreat recently, and they've got loads and loads of birds there. It's sort of like a paradise for birds. And you hear all these different bird songs. And then, you know, there are certain kinds of birds there are a lot of, and you can hear a lot of their bird song, and others you just hear once or twice. They've got loads and loads of wood pigeons, you know, and wood pigeons are like, doo, 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 doo. And then, you know, because I'm a musician, I'm quite sensitive, so I kind of notice the different wood pigeons, you know, like how they do it. You know, they're slightly different. Or, you know. And then I find myself getting into all kinds of judgments about, well, I like this wood pigeon song, I don't like that wood pigeon song, you know. Or this is quite a sensitive, quite creative wood pigeon. And this one's really quite an unimaginative one, because it's going, you know. And that's all just complete fabrication in my head. You know, it's not true, is it? It's just, it's not in the scene, in the herd, only the herd. It's in the herd, and then me making all these kind of judgments and stories. And in that situation, I can see exactly how absurd that is. Yeah. But often in everyday life, we're doing that and not even aware we're doing it. It's so much part of our habit, so much part of our conditioning. So that's why cultivating mirror like wisdom can really help and cut through, give us more insight, cut through our conditioning. So that was a bit of digression. So I'm coming back to Bahia now. This is what the Buddha said. Then, Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the scene, there will be only the scene. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. When for you there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then Bahia, there is no you in terms of that. When there is no you in terms of that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder, nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of dukkha. So that last bit may be a little bit confusing, but there's something about when we're doing that, what's happening is that our ego is getting in the way. You know, our views, our things are getting in the way and being added on. So if we can actually just have a thought, just have a sensation, just notice a smell, just notice a sound, just notice what we see, and we don't add that bit in, that's what he's saying, is there's no you in terms of that, you know. Because in a way, this sense of us, you know, from a Buddhist point of view, this sense of ourselves as a separate self and as a fixed self is the biggest delusion, you know, one of the ones that an insight we're trying to break through, yeah. And go beyond those sense of dualities and all those sorts of things that we do in every area of our life. Yeah? So it can be a very simple practice, you know, just seeing on a very mundane level what's happening, what we're experiencing, what's arising in our mind, what's arising around us, noticing our conditioning, noticing our reactions. But it's a very, very effective practice that can lead to a lot of insight and a lot of clarity, and I would encourage you to be doing more of it. So, I've been doing a lot of talking, and I think it might be quite nice to end with a little bit of chanting, maybe, and just sitting. But before that, I'm just going to read again an invocation to Akshobhya, which is by an ordinary member called Satchanama, which I find quite poetic and helped me evoke some of his qualities. So it will be recurring during this session that we will have this invocation, maybe some other invocations, to help us to connect maybe a bit more emotionally or poetically, imaginatively with Akshobhya. So if you sit quietly, I'll just read that, and then we'll chant his mantra as a plain mantra on just one note, and just repeat it till it fades. And remembering that when we chant a mantra, we're connecting with that figure, that Buddha, with their qualities, with enlightenment. It's a symbol just as much as a visual rupa is. The mantra is also the symbol of that Buddha, of enlightenment, of the qualities, in this case, of wisdom. Turning to the east, in the time before dawn, I bow to the deep blue light that is the Buddha, Akshobhya. Master of the depths, you sit on a pale blue lotus, touching the earth with the fingers of your right hand. Balanced in your left hand, perfectly upright, is the golden Vajra. You sit deep in meditation. You are the guardian of my depths. Your knowledge is deeper than 1,000 oceans. You are a universe unto yourself. In your heart, on a pale blue lotus, is the mystic seed syllable Hum. All deeds, all the past, all depth is contained within you. You are immutable, unshakable. You cannot be fathomed. There is a universe within your heart. You are the potential of the yet-to-be-born day, of the time before dawn, of light gathering below the horizon, waiting to emerge. You are gathering energy within you, like acorns waiting to grow, taking root. You are the water element that nourishes life. You are the wisdom of the great mirror, reflecting back all things, clearly and undistorted. You are the truth, the strange, mysterious truth of the depths, a truth which grows within us slowly, like the gradual dawning of a new day. There is a universe within your heart. Stepping into it, hands folded to my own heart, I enter the eastern pure land of Abhirati, the realm of complete joy. In this land, protected by you, no vows can be broken, no depths distorted, no falsehood spoken. It is a land of harmony with ourselves, of true and deep contact with what we really are. Once connected like this, we reside in a deep sense of well-being, of living in harmony with reality, rooted, unshakable, fulfilled, whole. O Vajrakshobhya, you protect this, you guarantee our depths, now and always. Om Vajrakshobhya Hum. Om Vajrakshobhya Hum. Om.